This talk is offered by Ordinary Mind Zendo. Ordinary Mind was founded by Barry Magid, Dharma heir of Charlotte Joko Beck, and is dedicated to her vision of a psychologically minded Zen practice adapted to the needs of American students practicing in the context of their everyday lives. Our public programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
In 1975, when I graduated from medical school, I moved to New York to begin my residency here at Roosevelt Hospital. And I must have had some time on my hands before that started, because my free time, I was able to enroll in library school up at the Columbia Rare Books School. And while I was up there, I got to study and handle all these wonderful old books, particularly I did a study of the books of the Three Mountains Press, which books published in Paris in the 20s by a fellow named William Byrd. And he published these little editions of Ezra Pound and William Carlos Williams and Ernest Hemingway and so forth. Very rare, very interesting things to be able to hold in your hand and see. And I was doing this because I didn't much enjoy medical school and felt that there was a whole side of my personality, a whole literary, scholarly side that wasn't finding much expression in medicine. And so I had this kind of determined idea that I would make sure I didn't let that literary side go completely fallow. And when I was in medical school, by chance, we had a big apartment with extra rooms, and by chance, I sublet one of those rooms to a fellow named Scott Johnson, who was adjunct teacher down at Rutgers, Newark, who had spent some time in Japan studying no drama and was saving up to go back there. And he had a wonderful, interesting literary background, which he shared with me. Somewhat faithfully, he also took me to a little shop in Greenwich Village called the Phoenix Bookshop, which was full of all these rare and small press editions of the poets I was interested in. Some of them, very hard to find. If you were trying to read these folks, you had to go to these rare bookmongers, because most of their stuff was out of print, and so you fell into this world. What did it take to find these rare books? And that sort of led me into library school and so forth and so on. The dilemma, though, was that there was this danger of becoming quite preoccupied with collecting old and rare books and sort of being able to have them for myself. And this was a good illustration of what Marx called commodity fetishism. This describes a scenario in which value is attributed to the object itself in a way that obscures all the subjective decisions and relationships and labor and power relations that go into its creation and valuing it the way it is. There's a whole world behind the object, but you only sort of seize on the object. And in my case, I think it was pretty transparent that what I was longing for was a relationship, an actual relationship with other writers and readers. And I didn't have a very good way to make that happen. So the temptation was to seize on the object rather than the relations. And going to library school was sort of a compromise move in that sort of I got to handle all these rare objects, and at the same time I got to meet people, actually study something, learn something, develop a kind of expertise. It wasn't private, it was back in an academic and relational world. Some years later, when I fell back into the world of book collecting in an attempt to hold on to all these rare editions and this literary world that was seemed far away, I remember pretty clearly one day saying, I need to do something more creative than just writing checks. And I decided to learn how to print these books myself. And I had been, this was inspired because I was reading through all of Thomas Merton in those days. And many of Thomas Merton's books were printed in very beautiful limited editions by a printer named Victor Hammer, who was down in Kentucky. And he carved his own typefaces, which he set by hand and hand printed these books, which just gorgeous. And of course, they were also quite expensive now. So I felt like, well, instead of just buying these books by this fellow, I want to learn how to do that myself. So I found a place called the Center for Book Arts and learned typesetting and printing. Tried to imitate one of Victor Hammer's books. And when you try to replicate something like that, you really see how much skill and craft goes into doing it. Now, the whole point of this has to do with how we think about work, what it is, and how it expresses who we are, and how easy it is for that to get lost in a world of things. An interesting discussion of this I just came across in a book of cultural history by Anson Robbenbach called The Human Motor. And it talks about the transformation of the idea of work into the idea of labor in the course of the 19th century. What's the difference? Hegel talked about work as how subjectivity expresses and imposes itself on the outer world. Part of how we know ourselves is through what we do. what we create and the impact we have on others. It is important in that picture that, and this is very relevant to Zen, excuse me, who we are is not a private inner experience, right? The real me is not a feeling deep inside. Who I am is discovered by how I am in the world. What are my relationships? What am I doing? What am I producing? What impact am I having on those around me? That's who I am. So all that complex notion of relationship and impact was the original idea of work. But capitalism transformed work into labor, simply a mechanical exertion of force in the service of a particular end. And in this way, labor became sort of reduced to the kind of work that physics described. Work in physics is a technical term for force applied across distance. And capitalism in the 19th century, Marx said, no longer is engaged with work in that old sense, but has reduced it simply to this mechanized, reproducible labor in which everyone is interchangeable and are just simply part of a mechanism. The human motor being a kind of image for this ideal capitalist worker. See, this picture is one of the instrumentalization of work until it's just a means to an end of producing something with no thought at all to the experience of the person doing it. For Marx, this was an inevitable stage in the development of capitalism. It was only going to change when there was a socialist revolution. Interestingly, there was a countervailing picture of socialism that was developed in England by John Ruskin and William Morris in the arts and crafts movement. And they attempted to redeem work in the old way. They tried to restore craft to work and the experience of making and creating to work. And Morris, as you probably know, developed through the arts and crafts movement a whole tradition of fine printing and tapestry making and painting, and in a sense, revival of many medieval crafts. And in a certain sense, Victor Hammer, the guy who was printing Merton's books that I was trying to imitate, was in the lineage of William Morris, this tradition of reviving an old-fashioned hand-set way of printing that would not be the most efficient, not be the most productive, but would restore art and craft to the business of printing. Now, as you know, I talk a lot about the dangers of instrumentalization in meditation practice, turning practice into a means to an end. right? The old definition of work in Hegel, where work is this expression of who we are, how we come out into the world through relation and impact, is very much, if I may venture to say so, like Dogen's picture of Zazen. See, Zazen is how we express who we are in the world. Zazen is the expression of our nature. When Dogen talks about the identity of practice and realization, he's saying that sitting itself, and particularly sitting as part of a whole monastic life, is the expression of our true nature. It's not a means of producing something else. We're not trying to get anywhere. In the very doing of it, we become who we are. It's performative. Now, an analogy of commodity fetishism that I was talking about in spiritual practice can be the kind of thing that's gotten called spiritual materialism, or we could call enlightenment fetishism. It's the idea that practice exists in order to create this commodity, enlightenment, which has enormous intrinsic value, and if only I can get my hands on it, I will have this rare, precious object that will give my life meaning from now on. It becomes an experience we want to have or even collect. And in the worst case scenario, show off to other people, right? Brag about having gotten it the way you might brag about having found a rare book. And in the same way that commodity fetishism obscures the world of labor and relationship that goes into the making and valuing of something, enlightenment fetishism tends to split off this momentary experience from the whole of your life and practice. See, we tend to lose sight of how is it that we want to live? What kind of person do we want to be? How do I want to treat other people? Right? What is my relationship to the other people in the Zendo? What is my responsibility to the Zendo in maintaining this practice and this tradition? Right? All of these things are sort of the complex questions about relationship and responsibility and ethics that get obscured when all we think about is having an enlightenment experience. Then it's this one momentary thing that has somehow gotten compartmentalized and sequestered, unconnected from all these complicated relational questions. When we talk about just sitting, it is an attempt to sit in a way that's simply expressive, not a means to an end of getting any kind of experience, but is the experience itself. And an experience that is not private and inside. It's not a particular subjective experience we're cultivating inside our head while we happen to be sitting here. Who I am is what I'm doing. Who I am is what I'm doing here with all of you. Our sitting, our nature, who I am, is what's happening here all together. See if you can feel that and express that as you just said.